My name is Ed Goldberg. Welcome to Author Author, an occasional series of conversations with authors touring through Portland or whom I have reached by phone. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the real pleasure to introduce Calvin Trillin. Calvin, may I call you Calvin?
Yes.
Please welcome to Portland. Although you've been here many times before.
Yes, I have.
Still like it?
Yes. Oh, it's one of my favorite places.
Yeah. Now, you've been living in Greenwich Village for, what, 150 years or so, even though you're originally from Kansas City?
Yeah. No, about one and a quarter, 100 and a quarter.
Okay.
But I still think of myself as sort of being from Kansas City and staying in New York. I think of myself as a resident out-of-towner.
Okay. Well, one thing I will ask you before we get rolling on your book is, if I want barbecue in Kansas City, where do I go?
Well, I think that the thinking now is that you go to LC's.
LC's?
LC's. A lot of people like a place called Oklahoma Joe's, which also has a good reputation, although I have a general rule. It's run by a white guy, and in Kansas City, unlike, say, Texas, I always say that going to a white-run barbecue joint is like going to a Gentile internist.
Taking your chances.
Yeah. It might come out all right, but you're not playing the percentages at all.
You know, as people will begin to understand, some people have a New York attitude even before they ever live in New York.
Right.
And I was born and raised there, so it came naturally to me. As you know, my parents were wise guys, you know.
Right.
But did it take you long to realize that you needed to be in the city in New York?
Well, I live in New York because when I started, that was sort of where, if you wanted to write for magazines or something, where you went.
Yeah.
I still value the Kansas City part of my life, and I wrote a book about my father, and I talked about how if you hear people talk about their childhoods, you can usually sum it up in a sentence, a kind of a theme, like we come from a noble family and you must not do anything to besmirch the name, or we're miserable because your father deserted us. And when I thought of what I wanted the theme of my daughter's childhood to be, they grew up in Greenwich Village, was, despite all evidence to the contrary, you're being raised in Kansas City.
You describe Greenwich Village once as a place where people from New Jersey come to test their car alarms. Still true?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Saturday night is the big test night.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about your book, because that's actually why you're here. The title of the book is Dogfight by Calvin Trillin, published by Random House, and this is what used to be referred to as a slim volume of verse. Yes?
Yeah, I guess so.
Ooh,
I don't think that whoever invented that term, I don't think it had this book in mind, but yes, it's verse and it's slim.
Okay, and I checked with you before, so I'm not insulting anything here. This is doggerel about the past election. True statement?
Yes, it's a long, the spine of it, or the thrust of it, is a long iambic pentameter. Well, let's not be afraid of the word epic here, an epic poem, and it's interrupted by other poems, some of which have been in The Nation week by week, and occasionally what we call a pause for prose. I mean, for instance, there's a piece of prose in there that's called Callista Gingrich, aware that her husband has cheated on and then left two seriously ill wives, desperately tries to make light of a bad cough.
Mm. Yes, there's also a really nice one about the homeschooling of Rick Santorum's children. I like that a lot.
Yeah,
also,
when Rick takes it over himself.
Yes, he does.
Says that Thomas Jefferson and the founding fathers did not intend there to be separation of church and state. And one of his little kids says, but Timmy says that that's Jefferson's phrase, the separation of church and state. And Santorum says, Timmy is inhabited by Satan. I think it's Timmy Burnside.
Yeah, you can't argue with that, though, really, can you? Mort Saul used to famously come out. He was a political comedian of the 50s and early 60s.
Yes.
Came out with a New York Times tucked under his arm, and sometime during the course of his act, which was usually brilliant political satire, he would say, you know, this stuff writes itself. Do you feel that way about the election and the poetry you've written about the election?
Well, it certainly was colorful. And one of the other pieces of prose is based on a New York Times article about how uncomfortable Mitt Romney is when mixing with people and supposedly making small talk. And the piece from the Times itself is very funny. And so, yeah, to a certain extent, it writes itself. And you know, even if things that aren't good for the country, but if they're entertaining, the way people in the small joke trade feel about it is the way dentists feel about tooth decay. You say, well, it's a pity, but where would business be without it?
Yeah, one of the things you talk about in this book is the alleged soon-to-be demise of the Republican Party, the GOP, something which has been talked about before. The first election I voted in was in 1964, where Barry Goldwater lost everything but the household china, and the Republicans were supposed to disappear after that, and then after Watergate, and they keep coming back.
And they were supposed to disappear in 2008. And I read a couple of books on the Tea Party before I did this, and there's one of the people who goes on television, you know, on these shows like the Sunday talk shows, people I call the Sabbath gas bags, just said there's not a chance that the Republicans will win Congress in 2010. Not a slim chance, not a chance. And now, of course, there's a lot of soul searching about why they lost. Actually, I wrote a poem about that called, of course, Republican Soul Searching. We're searching our souls and we're wondering why we got beat so badly, our rivals are gloating. It's obvious now where our campaign went wrong. We should have prevented more people from voting.
Mm. There's too much truth in that for me to laugh, excuse me.
Yeah. I was a bit offended by the voting suppression thing myself.
I think you're alone in that, quite frankly.
I have to say, it seemed contrary to what my elementary school teachers told us about our duties in democracy. And then there's a lot of talk now that demographically the Republicans, I read in some column, are trying to hold back a storm surge wave with a white picket fence. Mm-hmm. And I actually wrote a poem when they were selecting a vice president, when we thought they might select one of the, they happen to have a number of rather attractive candidates who are not white men. And this is called Cuisine Diversity. If Rubio, Jindal, or Haley, or Rice got put on the ticket by Romney as vice, Republicans possibly then could entice some voters who like to eat food that has spice and not stick with voters who think that a slice of white bread's the food that will always suffice.
Yeah, I wonder about Bobby Jindal. I'm already convinced is not everything he's cracked up to be.
Well, he also has a problem of being so much like the page on 30 Rock.
Yeah,
that it's hard to take him seriously.
Kenneth Page. That guy who's a bit dim and doesn't even know how dim he is.
Yes, it's sort of naive. He just looks that way, kind of a dorkiness that's hard to.
And Nikki Haley always looks like she's embarrassed about everything she says.
Well, maybe she's embarrassed.
Yeah, I think she might actually
be. That's a possibility.
I think she's seizing the main chance here and is really, can't look at herself in the mirror in the morning to put her makeup on. And Marco Rubio has yet to demonstrate exactly how stupid he is, but I imagine he's up to the task.
Well, he was, he sort of revealed at least what he's willing to do when they ask him how old the earth is. And he said it's sort of a theological question, whether it was 7 days or seven eras. And I think he's certainly willing to play to those people if he isn't one of them himself. And there's another theory, of course, that they lost the election because every time Romney tried to go to the center, and there's, as you remember, this sort of second debate where suddenly all this neocon stuff was forgotten, and he was talking about how peaceful he was. I did a poem called Mitt Romney Beats His Swords into Plowshares, and then after the third debate, when he got even softer, I did one called Mitt Romney Beats His Plowshares into Feather Dusters.
Yeah. And they're all contained in this book. So.
Yeah. But meanwhile, these people like Todd Akin
a gift from the gods.
A gift from the gods for the Democrats.
Like Murdoch.
Murdoch and Akin. And the other guy who said there shouldn't be an exception for life of the mother because with modern technology, there's no problem there.
Yeah, also, I mean, it showed its ugly head in the 2010 elections when people like Sharon Angle and Christine O'Donnell emerged from the Tea Party morass and proceeded to humiliate themselves and the Republican Party in the process.
Although we really treasured Christine O'Donnell. She was not only the first candidate I can remember in my experience had to deny that she was a witch, and also campaigned against masturbation. I thought that you're just not the sort of thing that you usually get in a senatorial race.
Boy, there's a losing proposition if ever I heard
That's
one.
Right.
That's right. As Woody Allen said about that, I don't put it down. It's sex with someone I love.
Right. At least gave me the opportunity to talk about TV anchors and wankers.
Well, there's a talk about a rhyme made in heaven. Huh?
Right.
I say, if the vice presidential candidates were an interesting mix, nothing surpasses the, and I say this with a new level of meaning to the cliche, right, an embarrassment of riches, all of the people that ran for president in 2012 in the Republican primaries.
Yeah, it was amazing. Everybody said, well, the first-tier candidates didn't run. And I say in this book, though first-tier candidates were mostly out, Republicans were asking, what about the second tier or what about the third? Has nothing from those other tiers been heard? You have to realize that in this race, Donald Trump was once in the lead in the polls. So you can imagine what the field was like.
Yes, and Herman Cain.
The Herminator was
fabulous guy. I mean, his 999 program, you know, 999 is the British equivalent of 911. It's what you call when there's an emergency.
Right.
And all I could think of was, oh, my God, you know.
It will be an emergency.
It will be an emergency. That's right. Rick Perry is the guy I really loved. I mean, you know, we all know about Newt.
Right. And Newt jokes are kind of old. Rick was a nice, fresh joke. Had gorgeous hair. I remember being taken in to meet him once when I was in Texas for the book fair by Kinky Friedman. Remember?
Oh,
Kinky?
Yeah, I know Kinky, yeah.
Kinky used to have Kinky Friedman and the Texas Jew Boys, and
yes,
then he ran for governor once with, I guess, against Perry, with a great campaign slogan. It was Kinky Friedman for governor, how hard could it be?
And right.
He took me and said, you got to see his hair. And he had, and Perry's a good rhyme, too. It even rhymes with, the space beneath the hair is airy. So I liked him. And I also pointed out with his sort of Texas appearance with his cowboy boots and everything, and he always planted his cowboy boots up on a bale of hay when he was at a country fair or something, that actually he was a cotton farmer. He and his family had a cotton farm, and you don't need any horses to plant cotton. So why the cowboy boots? That if he were really an authentic Texas person, he should be wearing bib overalls.
Not to mention the other unfortunate associations with cotton plantations anyway. But,
right, that's true.
Probably East Texas then, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah. The thing about Perry that I loved is I watched the debates. I didn't bother really to watch all of them because the real good guys dropped out way too soon,
right,
you know? But I watched Perry, and I was reminded of that Groucho Marx remark from the film where he says, gentlemen, he may look like an idiot, and he may talk like an idiot, but don't let that fool you. He really is an idiot.
Right. Well, he was, you know, it's hard to remember now, but when he came in, he was considered a really strong candidate who might get the nomination. He was from a place that had added a lot of jobs, and supposedly the election was just going to be about jobs. And he had never lost an election in his life. And but he just wasn't ready for all of this.
He may never be.
He may never be. I mean, I think his most devastating moment was when he couldn't remember the third department he was going to eliminate.
The oops moment.
Oops moment.
Yeah.
But I think that was effective in ending his campaign only because we already had the idea of who he was. I mean, anybody can have what they call a brain freeze. I mean, that's not impossible. So I didn't think that show much, but it's sort of like when Dan Quayle couldn't spell potatoes or whatever it was, that I can't spell potatoes sometimes, or I have some question about whether there's that E there.
He was a lot younger than you at the time.
A lot younger, that's true. But also it fit in with what people generally thought of him.
Exactly. I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Calvin Trillin, the Calvin Trillin. I'm very happy to have you here. The title of his latest slim volume of verse is Dogfight, published by Random House. Now, you mentioned before that we've seen and done the new jokes endlessly now since like 1994, I suppose.
Right.
And yet, as I read this, your verses, I said to myself, you know, all this stuff is mostly amused disdain, but you seem to have a real venom for Newt Gingrich. Is that true?
I don't think Newt behaves very well.
Neither do I. He's a real creep.
I mean, I think that his marital history is, and you have to remember that while he was cheating on the ill wife, on the second ill wife, he was leading the charge against Clinton for not keeping his marriage vows. So, yeah, I think there are candidates. I mean, there are a lot of candidates who I might disagree with, but they all do things that make you shudder. But I mean, somebody like, I don't know, John McCain or something, or George H.W. Bush, I have a lot of respect for them in various ways, and even if we disagree. But occasionally there's one. Rudy Giuliani would be another one.
Oh, brother.
That I think, well, there's a character issue there.
Yeah, I think you're right. And when he was elected mayor of New York, even though I have not lived in New York for 40 years, I might tell you, I was horrified. It was a regression. It was back to the days of Tammany Hall, only he was a Republican.
Right.
Yeah. So read us something about Newt Gingrich. You have a couple of really nice pieces in there about Newt. You got something at hand you can read?
It's one I didn't mark here, but I'll take a look. Oh, here. Here's two attempts to explain the resurrection of Newt Gingrich.
Okay, good.
Yes, Newt appeared dead at least twice. If Mitt's guys were playing it smart, they would have made certain of that by driving a stake through his heart. But Newt might have said, if they had, "Proceed, Mitt, you'll see I won't mind it. You're free to drive stakes through my heart, except that you'll first have to find it."
Yeah. So...
Adelson. I have a poem about Adelson, Newt's sugar daddy.
Oh, brother. Yeah, another one.
Sheldon Adelson.
Yeah. Who made his money in an honest way by stealing it from people at casinos.
Right.
Yeah.
And bribing foreign governments. Sung by Newt Gingrich supporters to the tune of Edelweiss from The Sound of Music.
Yes.
You can hum along if you like, Ed.
Thank you.
Adelson, your donations do cheer him. We who root for our Newt. Smile whenever you smear him. Absent your vow that you would endow Newt despite his clay feet. Adelson, Newt would be back on K Street.
As indeed he will be.
Right.
I sometimes write doggerels, and I have to admit they come to me in bunches like grapes, and then I have long dry periods in between. Right. Do these things pop into your head, or do you actually work at them? What's your process for writing these?
Well, the weekly ones... I set the shower head to iambic pentameter on Sunday night.
Excellent idea.
And that they just sort of come out. These I had to work on because I had to sort of keep up with the campaign. And I actually had to go back some, and then eventually I was working in real time. So I pretty much had to set goals of how many lines I was writing every day. And as you say, sometimes it comes and sometimes it doesn't come. I always think of being able to write verse as a sort of minor facility that some people have, in the way that usually there's a guy in the family who can do something like bend his thumb back and touch his wrist. And it's sort of like that.
Yeah. I've noticed that writers who have been trained for writing on deadline are usually the best writers, in the sense that they sit down and they write every day,
right,
or they try to sit down and write every day, whereas somebody like me, who's lazy in the extreme, I would rather wash dishes than sit down to write. The old thing about writing is that you roll a sheet of paper into your typewriter, then you stare at it until drops of blood appear in your forehead. That's more like it is with me. So is that what your process is? Do you sit down every day and write something?
I don't write every day necessarily. I mean, now I'm on a book tour. I'm not writing every day. And so there are other things to do. And sometimes I'm reporting. Most of the things I've written have been reporting pieces for The New Yorker. But I sort of figure out what I need to do. And when I have a piece to write, I decide, I call it the Committee of National Goals. That's an Eisenhower administration commission. And I picture these old guys with long white beards sitting up on a platform, and I give them excuses, and they just won't hear it. Mm. I say, gee, I don't feel very well today. So just tell it to somebody else. And they tell me how much I have to write. And people use different methods. I think the key to this is that God obviously did not intend people to make a living as a writer. And so you have to invent something that works. I often talk about a conversation I had with another New Yorker writer who came into my office once when I worked more up there. And we started talking about this. And he talked about his process every day. And it was so complicated, and it took him about 15 or 20 minutes. And he ended with going to the same copy shop, copying what he had produced that day, putting the original back in his office, going home, and then putting the Xerox copy into a strong box in a crawl space above the kitchen that he had decided would be the last place to go in case he and his family were destroyed in a conflagration.
Is this guy related to Edgar Allan Poe at all?
Right. And then he ended all this by saying, do you think that's neurotic? And I said, no. No, if you can write the next day, since God did not intend for you to do this, you have to figure out some way to fool him and to do it. If that works, if you can write the next day, fine. Sounds good to me.
Yeah, I'm saying it's like watching a pitcher on the mound, you know, whatever ticks and things
right.
that he goes through, you know, twitches.
But when I first got to the New Yorker, a rather avuncular writer, it was a very good writer, said to me that he wrote in finished paragraphs. You know, he didn't go on to the next, and this is a nonfiction writer who has a lot of information to fit into some one place or another. And he didn't go on to the next paragraph until he had pretty much had that one finished and the way it was going to be handed in. And if I did that, I'd still be working on my first paragraph. I couldn't do it.
But, it's the accretion philosophy of writing.
But, yeah. So I think everybody just figures out how it works for him.
You've written novels. You've written nonfiction. You've written personal essays. Any plays?
I wrote a play many, many years ago. That was sort of an outgrowth of a book of short stories or kind of fictional essays I did called Barnett Frummer is an Unbloomed Flower about trendiness in the 60s. Everybody said, well, it's a pain to get one produced. And the first person we showed it to a couple weeks later called and said, yeah, we'll produce this. And that was the high point. Everything went downhill from there. And then I wrote a sort of stage version of a memoir I did on my wife.
Yes.
And what's going to happen to that, I don't know.
Yeah. Do you still miss her?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought you would say that. The dust jacket of your book has a wonderful, the title of the book is Dogfight, and it's Mitt and Obama rendered as dog-like humans by one of the great New Yorker cartoonists. I forget his
Barry
name.
Blitt.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a genius.
Yeah. The only regret I have of this book is there weren't more of his cartoons scattered through the book.
Well, that would have been nice. He did do one on the back of Joe Biden and Paul Ryan as dogs. So having it in both the front and the back was great. And he did the last book in a boxing ring with the last book? McCain and Obama.
Yeah, well, how about that?
Yeah, we've already forgot that.
Yeah, well, it's how could you forget Sarah Palin, though? Sarah Palin
she was good to have around. For that book, I did a poem, Sarah Palin singing the old Barbra Streisand classic, On a Clear Day, I See Vladivostok.
There was a fact that it's almost a throwaway in the book that at one point, is it all of the candidates or but one were in the pay of Fox News?
That's right.
Yeah, tell
I think
us about
all
that.
But Mitt Romney. Well, that's the sort of, I mean, it used to be that out of work politicians went to one of these think tanks in Washington. Or a law firm where their name was good to have on the door. And now they go to work for Fox News. I think, except for Romney, I think at that point all of them had some arrangement with Fox News. Yeah. I thought Blitz cover, which for The New Yorker during that campaign, 2008, where he had the Obamas in turbans and giving themselves
Great, the fist bump.
The fist bump.
Terrorist fist bump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I know and just several black friends called me. They were outraged at this.
Really?
Because they thought the people wouldn't get it. I thought that it was brilliant, but that they should have put a little Fox logo on the lower right. So that was sort of the Fox view of it. But he had a great cartoon just before the election of Romney having tattoos removed of various things positions he had held in the past. And of course, the guy who was removing him was Norman Rockwell.
Yes. The Etch-a-Sketch moment is, if anything done by their side in innocence damaged their campaign more, I would like to know what it is.
Well, I think Etch-a-Sketch was not good, but I think that the real blow was the 47%.
Yeah.
And I still don't know who had the video camera or cell phone, whatever it was, in there to do that, which is very interesting. I assume we're going to know sometimes. I like to think it was one of the fat cat donors' wives. She hates her husband. She likes the house in Boca Raton. She likes the Lexus. She loves the private plane, but she hates her husband. So she got back at him.
This reminds me of something, and this is way out of left field, and excuse me for foisting this on you, but I really wanted to know what your reaction to this is. All the while I watched John McCain during the campaign, his wife was on stage with him, and she had a fixed smile on her face. But if you looked at her eyes were not smiling. Her eyes betrayed some kind of turmoil going on. I'm just reading it into it. But of all the people connected with that Republican campaign, the only one I really want to talk to was his wife. I would really like to find out what goes on in that blonde mind, because I think there's more going on than we know about.
I have no idea. I didn't notice that in her eyes. And of course, it's a difficult role playing the spouse. We used to talk about the possibility of having Nancy Reagan's adoring smile surgically removed. I mean, she was the best at it, but she was a former actress. And she could probably be thinking about what she was going to have for dinner or something and you have to realize during that adoring smile, she'd already heard that speech 20 times. So, but it's a hard role to play. I thought that Ann Romney, Mitt Romney's wife, and I think most people thought this, was a much more appealing character.
Without question.
That she actually seemed to be able to connect with her fellow human beings, unlike her husband.
Well, she had real reactions, unlike Mitt. There are very few real reactions that he had. One of them, of course, was, I'll bet you $10,000, which turned out to be to his detriment. So he was so closed up, he was so taut, he was so restrained by the end of the campaign that the only realness going on the stage was
Ann. Well, I think that he was very uncomfortable with people, and that's why some of his answers came out kind of odd. Says, at retail politics, we'd see no more ham-handed candidate since Albert Gore. I once referred to Albert Gore as a man-like object. Without the common touch that was, say, Truman's, Mitt didn't seem quite comfortable with humans. His small talk with the citizens appeared to be not only very small but weird, weird facts with no connection in his chatter, and questions to which answers didn't matter.
And with that, I think I will close the interview. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Ed.
The title of the book is Dogfight, the Verses Therein, composed by Calvin Trillin. Thank you so much for coming. Published by Random House. I hope you come through town again, and I hope I get the chance to talk to you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Author, produced at the studios of All Classical KQAC-FM in Portland. My name is Ed Goldberg. You can find these programs at our website, allclassical.org/author. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back soon.